That's called Unreal 12. We were talking about your time back at Wildon in the winter of 1945-46. How did life go on then? What's the main things you remember of the time?
Life was slow, but the one thing I do remember is the children and the ladies, which was new to us, all wore trousers. All the ladies wore trousers in winter, and all the children wore them, which was new to us, because ladies didn't wear trousers in England in them days. No, the children didn't. But they did. Everybody wore trousers there because it was snow all the time. I mean, coming back from Vienna, it was in November, so it wasn't long before Christmas was around, but snow was already there. But anyway, what we had done in this Snaps factory that we was in, well, Snaps distillery that we were listed in the building itself. My workshop was across the road. It was a garage across the road. And the officers and headquarters, the officers themselves, they were in actual building, village itself, or town cities. And we was in this Snaps factory. And that was our billet, and that was my workplace.
You mentioned that.
Yeah. And I don't know how it come about, but we mobilised. Next door was a guest house. We mobilised two of the ladies to work in our cookhouse. And I don't know how they got paid, who paid them, or whether it was... they won't work for nothing. Whether they were paid in kind, I don't know. Probably food, I don't know. But anyway, one of them worked in the cookhouse, helped the cook, and the other one served the meals to us, or helped to serve the meal. We helped ourselves most of the time, but they washed up and everything. Same as you, of course. Well, I had two German prisoners working with me in the garage, and I think there was one working in the building itself, or two in the building itself, cleaning, etc. But anyway, the guest house was a family affair, seemingly, because there was these two sisters lived there with their husbands, and I don't know who else at that time. But eventually, they brought people in at Christmas. We had our own Christmas festivities. The officers always served our Christmas dinner and everything. That was usual right throughout the army. And every Christmas, wherever I've been in the war, different countries, the officers always served the Christmas meal. And then Christmas Eve, Christmas night, these ladies got other ladies in, and they served us an evening meal that they concocted for ourselves and them. And we tried to get some entertainment going, such as a dance and things like that. Well, I don't know who played the music in that. We got the music, but there's all the room in the middle of the floor to have a dance. But we entertained ourselves. I think they provided the drink. We paid for it, but they provided it. And we had a good evening, and I got a photograph to prove it. And that was taken in Christmas 1945, which I kept as a memory. And another couple of photographs were taken at Wildon, and they came out in my story later in life.
Now, one thing you were saying, you were sent off to do a repair to a Jeep in the mountains.
Oh, yes.
You had a bit
of
trouble in the mountains. Can you tell us about that?
That was an experience I'll never forget. I don't know why on earth I was sent on my own, and I think I was lucky to get back. But my breakdown, it wasn't a big heavy lorry, but it was a breakdown, but a four-wheel drive, which was off different to the lorries. They were two-wheel drive, but mine was four-wheel drive. And I realised when I see where I got to go, I set off without, I put my chains on first, all four wheels. And I set up this mountain track. By word of mouth, I was told that the ski slopes were up there. And I set off and weren't so bad the first mile or so. But eventually, I would definitely find it difficult to keep going, even with the chains on. And it was only another strike, and there was a lay-by about every 100 yards or so, which you couldn't understand why. But anyway, I met a Jeep coming down, and he says,
"No way can you get any further than where you are now." He says, "Anyway," he says, "what are you going for?" I told him. Well, so the jeep is in working order again. Now you don't have to worry about that. So, but my worry now is to get you back down to the bottom. Because you've never come. He said, I have got up here this, as far as this anyway. So he progressed me round to turn around one of his laybys, and he took me down to the bottom of the slope. And I don't know who the person was, but he took me to his camp. His camp was quite near where the bottom of the village at the bottom of the slope. And I then would hot meal and set up back to my own place, which was, if I remember, I was 4 or 5 miles away. But I never knew who that person was. I never knew what company was in or anything. I don't remember anyway, should I put it that way. I would have known at the time. But that was my experience of going up a ski slope.
Some of the men, I think, went away on skiing lessons and things. That wouldn't apply to you MT, would it?
We never went. We never were asked to go. They might have been posted up in the companies, but I never. If I was an Arnold, I had no interest in skiing anyway. But anyway, there were some people who wanted to go skiing. I expect besides the officers, but quite a few officers went, I know, and probably some men. I mean, some of the men in those days, they would like skiing, same as the horse riding. But always find some people that will do something different to anybody else. I mean, I would never ride a horse again. I got on a horse once while I was in Austria, and I only got off it, only got in a bump.
Now, what about D-Mobile? It started to become more important, didn't it, as Christmas came and went?
As Christmas went. Now, we knew that the mob would be coming soon, because it'd be talked about right throughout the world and throughout England, and we got the bits and newspapers. But anyway, we knew it would be coming somehow after Christmas. And the first lot was the oldest persons that was in the army. Well, my brother was one of the oldest ones that was in it, and he was one of the first ones to go out. So he went out. He left us at Bilden about sometime in early January. Well, during January, there was all sorts coming from the notice board. I mean, I was finishing my studies when I came in the army, and I was preparing to sit for my higher national certificate. I got my national certificate. I sit for my higher national certificate.
That was in what?
In 1939.
No, so in what subject?
In engineering. And so they was asking these things on the notice board, and we filled in forms in, and it was suggested that people that wanted to finish the studies, such as myself, that already started schools in Italy, and they wanted to allocate how many so they could know what subjects to start on these courses. So I put my name down to finish my studies, and I think they were expecting people to stop 6 months. If you want to start the studies, you've got to stay in the army to complete them. But anyway, I couldn't see when I would be out, so I put my name down, and that's the last I heard of it. It was accepted, and quite a few more people put theirs down for different things. But all the courses were back in Italy, strange to say. But anyway, February came around, and there wasn't many left in the battalion by then. And they decided to finish the battalion as well. But I got my demob, and the rest of the battalion was completely finished as well.
So they weren't all demobilised, were they? Because some of the ones with time to serve went on to...
Time to serve. There was about 90% demobbed, and the rest had to serve. Now, Major Stringer, he finished up in Graz, in the offices there, because that was the headquarters for the southern area of Austria. And so I'm assuming quite a few of his staff would be ex-DMI men. This has got time to finish. But the ones that were called up, such as myself, they were all demobbed, and I think the battalion finally closed about the 26th of February.
So what about your journey home after the demob itself?
Well, the journey home was about 2 days quicker than the journey on the Leap, because we used a train, as well as the lorries. We used trains for going through the Alps, which were better than the lorries, of course. But that was a journey in itself. I mean, I've seen these trains on the on the pictures. I've never been on one where they're going up these hills and they hear the clackety clacks, and that's the rack that's underneath. So if they lose power, they don't run back down, they stop. But anyway, we was hoping that we won't lose the power getting to the top, which we did. And that part of the journey was pretty quick. And it took us 2 days to get home, back to Cali, but it took us 4 days before. Then went across to Dover again, and from there, went to Aldershot. From Aldershot to a place near Reading.
That's Woking, I think you've got in there.
That's where we got the civilian clothes. That was a factory rather than a military depot. It was a factory, and I think it was organised through the military, and they were providing clothes for us. And your choice of so many different types of suits. You allowed one suit, one this and one other. And
what did you think of your D-Mob clothes?
Well, it was nice to get D-Mob things on, but they were good. There was no doubt about it. They lasted a long time. They were well cut, and they didn't just hang on you. You could have any size and shape you wanted because there were that many different sizes. They'd work well in presenting them like more or less Marks and Spencers do today. I mean, you can go get a coat, and then you'll get sizes off another peg, any size you want, and that's how it was there.
What else happened there? Anything else you were issued with?
Well, we were given a piece of string. No, that was just to tie the box up for our clothes, to carry our clothes in. We didn't put the D-Mob things on. They were given them all in a box, a collapsible box. And we brought them all home in a box, besides the kit bag.
You also got the D-Mob allowance and war gratuity.
Yes.
Which you work out in total to be £84, well, 19 pence is new money, but £84 anyway. You weren't particularly happy with that at the time, from what you say now, or were you? I mean, is that later on you've got...
It seemed a lot of money all in one lump, as what we've been having, of course. But looking back, I wondered how we managed as we did. I mean, I don't know whether other people remember what they got, but I mean, I'd been in such a long time, and when you see it was so many weeks, 75 weeks at...
75 months.
75 months at 12 shillings a month, which was at 60 pence lit.
That's £45 it comes to, yeah. You've worked it out,
yes.
I see, actually, it is 19 shillings, not 19 pence, yeah. So it's £84, 19 shillings, just under £85.
Yeah.
Because you got some post-war credits as well.
And I could never understand where the post-war credits come in, how they come in on two different dates. One's halfway through the war, the war, was it 1941?
1942, yeah.
1942 to 1945.
So what did you plan to do? You'd come out of the army, I mean...
Well, the instructions were to all the people, the employed people, that to give the persons the job back.
Now, you'd been at the Silverwood Colliery?
Silverwood Colliery. Well, I'd worked the colliery from leaving school. So I was prepared to go back to carry on because I was still an apprentice when I left. When I went to the army, I hadn't finished my apprentice because, I mean, even them days, my apprentice didn't finish until I was 22. Because I was in the army then. So virtually, I hadn't finished my apprentice, but I had, in one sense. So I had to go back to the colliery. Because if you didn't go back to the colliery or to the job that you had when you went in the army, if you refused to go back, you lost all ties on the people that employed you.
So you went back on, I think, the 10th of March, 46.
That's right, yes.
How was it to go back to the fitting shop after all that time? You'd left as a little lad almost, and you'd gone back a man. How did you fit back into the fitting shop?
Well, strange to say, it didn't look as though it altered at all. One or two new faces in the actual fitting shop itself, because one or two of us had, I think a couple had been lost during the war. But there wasn't many, what many had gone. There's only about six of us gone out of the blacksmith and fitting shop, which were both together. out of the old shots, I think there's only six of us have been called up. The rest were made reserve occupation. By the time we had sorted out that the war was going to finish just there and then, all the rest were made reserve occupation, the mine workers. But it was too late, we were already called up then. But anyway, it seems as though it isn't that altered. The shop itself, you've got the same machines in, all the same machines, no new machines, because you couldn't have no machines in those days. And it was still owned by the private companies. I went back and carried on with more or less where I left off. I had the same cupboard I had. The person who had it emptied it for me to have my tools back in. And eventually, within a short while, I was assistant foreman. Within 15 months, I was assistant foreman. Because I was interested in the job. And I'd worked it all the time I was in the army.
So you didn't mind going back to...
No, I didn't mind going back. My wife didn't want me to go back. She wanted me to go to work for Rolls-Royce at Barnoldswick, which is in West Yorkshire. Why? Because her sister lived near there, and her sister was so close, and I was close to her sister and her family. But I didn't want to start new work, actually. I wanted to carry on where I'd left off.
You were happier to do
that? I was happy carrying on.
Did you not feel a bit frustrated? Because you must have gained a lot of skills over the years.
Yes, I was a little bit frustrated at first, but I soon settled in. Because there was a new type of work started just after I got back, which was the coal cutting machines, mechanical cutting machines, which they hadn't had when I went to the army. And I got straight into those and got topside of that job, then moved on to the powerhouse and went as the powerhouse fitter, which was one of the top jobs. And in the powerhouse, at the weekend, you had three or four men with you. The repairs in the powerhouse and the winding engines, and from that step on, then next thing that came along was the coal board.
Did you support the nationalisation of the mines?
Well, I had to do it at the time, so we didn't have much choice. But it helped me considerably because the foreman, he turned his back on the coal board completely. As soon as the coal board took over, he put his nose to the left. Mind you, he was 68, and I was assistant foreman, so of course I applied for his job and got his job. And then his was a daily paid job. I took his job and I had to go on the staff and pay superannuation. So I was still on the daily wage, but I was paying superannuation, which in them days was no superannuation paid by anybody but the staff people anywhere. The work people, that there was no pensions being paid by any work people in those days. But I started paying superannuation towards pension because I was got the first step on the ladder for the staff. Eventually, as years went by, I finished up the engineer at Colliery.
So you did well when you got back?
Yes, I kept on and I worked the job. There's one spell I did do while I was the foreman, before I went on the senior staff. I started teaching at the technical school. One of our managers put me a word into the technical school because I was teaching a lot of mining students then days. After the coal board took over, the mining students went on one day release, and they wanted people to teach them in their workshops. So I went to the technical school. I did about 2 years of technical school, teaching mining students in the workshops. And there was one period where they were short on the evening classes, and I did 6 months teaching other people on the evening classes and engineers in the workshops.
So, now, did you feel that your war experiences had done you good or bad physically and mentally?
Well, I think it had done me good, physically and mentally. Because I never, shall I put it this way, I never rejected being in the army. I enjoyed my army service. It was a bit rough. Well, it was a lot rough, a lot of times. But I never cribbed about it, like some people. They never settled from the day they went in to the day they come out. So a friend of mine, he lived in London, worked at Adams Press. He detested being in the army from the day he went in to the day he came out.
So you feel that your more positive thing that served you well in the long run?
Yes, I think it served me well in the long run.
Did you have any of the problems like nightmares or problems like that?
I don't think I did.
What about now? I know you're a very keen member of the association, the 16th Battalion, have a very active association within the DLI Association.
Right.
It's a separate part of it, isn't it? Well, you went right to the very early ones, didn't you?
Yes, I went to the very early ones. But I missed the ones in between when I was bringing my family up.
Can you tell us a story? It's just an interesting one about how you went to the first one. The first one was in 47.
47. And it was at Leeds, and the association officials at that time made it in Leeds because that was the centre of England, because there were so many people in the Durham Light Infantry all over England. They thought the better the first gathering in Leeds, which was more or less the centre. Easy for transport. All the trains went to Leeds more or less from all over the country. That was the main reason. And it was in the town hall at Leeds. And a lovely summer's day, it was in August, I believe.
Now, you weren't actually going originally. How come you went?
Well, I wasn't going because I couldn't afford it, as I thought. I couldn't afford the rail fare. But anyway, this man at the work, I was assistant foreman at the time, and we were doing repair on one of the winding engines, and it was about 11:45 on the Saturday, and we'd been working all morning on this particular engine, and I had to be talking to this particular man who was a lot older than me. He'd been in the First World War, and I said, I never ought to be here today, struggling about with this blinking job. I says, my brother's gone to Leeds, and it's our reunion, 16th Battalion Light Infantry reunion dinner, the first one. What? Army reunion? I says, yes. He said, well, look, he said, I'll tell you now, Sam, put them tools down, I'll look after the rest of the work, we've done what's necessary, it's only got to be put back together again. He says, you get off. He says, what time's your meal? I said, I think it's 4 o'clock. I think the meal's for 4 o'clock. He says, where is it at? I said, Leeds. He says, look, you've plenty of time to get there, there's plenty of trains to Leeds from Rotherham. Get off. So I went home, wiped. Flabbergasted had seen me, she was quite pleased. She said, I'm right pleased. She said, I've been worried about you. I must have been saying something at home the night before. She said, I'm right worried. I says, I'm pleased you're going. So I got on the tram. The tram was in them days.
Now, why did he tell you had to go?
You'll thoroughly enjoy it. It's something you'll be sorry you missed it if you don't go. All those pals that you've been with all these years, he says, you'll miss them. He says, if you miss the first one, you'll not go to the next one. You'll forget all about it then. So I went to the first one.
Had he been to his own one?
He'd been to his own in the past, and they'd more or less finished, more or less died and finished, and there were not enough to run. But he'd been to quite a few of his own, his regiment. He was in the First World War. And he says, you'll never be sorry for going, so you go.
And when you got there, did you enjoy it?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, it was a lovely day. I'd been to Leeds numerous of times, and going into Leeds Town Hall, I knew where it was, and now I'd get there, and went searching, saw all these fellas, and went searching for my brother, found my brother and his wife, because I mean the wives were allowed to go, you see, but they had to come out, they weren't there at the dinner, of course, but they were all round about outside, and I got there in time, and I got home, landed in Rotherham, I think it was about 2:02. The train that got me in Rotherham, and if Dan had pulled up in Rotherham, I should have been still on the train going to Gloucester. I think it was going to Gloucester that day. I'd had enough to drink and I was asleep, and it woke me up, pulled up in Maslow Station at Rotherham, and I walked home. Fully enjoyed it.
Now, you've been going, except when you had family commitments, you've been going ever since, and you've just had the 50th one. I've just seen a picture of you and 30 odd of the lads and some of the officers, Vizard and the rest of them, that we've interviewed actually. Are they still important to you, the reunions?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, there's two fellas I met. I met one this time, and he'd never been till 8 years ago. And he came, and he lives in Durham, and he'd never been inside the cathedral.
Who is that?
A man called Starr. He's not in our battalion, but he was in the Durham, but he wasn't in our battalion. But he met one of his mates, who, in fact, he stayed with him, comes from Nottingham. And they went together 8 years ago, and they've been every year since. And he's now so interested in the cathedral. He'd never been until 8 years ago. So when I spoke to him in September this year, I said, well, I'd meet you to it. I said, I was in here in 1948.
That's when they switched from Leeds to...
That's right.
Why did they switch from Leeds to Durham?
Well, I think it because there were disillusions somehow. That I don't know how, but Major Stringer will probably tell you more about that, or the other two fellas that have been running it for a long while.
And do you think that the association should carry on? I mean, you're all pushing on a little now.
Yes.
How long do you think it can go on?
I think another 2 years, and then there'll not be enough people left to run it. I think another 2 years. I mean, I'm 78 now. I should be 80 then, but those that's run it, I think they're 2 or 3 years older than me. But I think another 2 years, it'll more or less, there'll not be enough people to run it.
So the old First World War, your old foreman, the bloke who was helping with the machine, the First World War, he was right then?
Yes, he was right, yes.
It's still important to you?
Still important, yes. I mean, I met a fella at Caister who was in the First Army, same as the Durham in the First Army, and he should have gone this year to Durham, but he'd already committed himself going to Italy with a group of First Army personnel at the same week as we should have been at Durham. Right, well, I've got him the photograph, sent him the photograph, and he asked me to try and find a certain person. And also, could I find out if a certain person's name is in the Book of Remembrance in the cathedral? Well, I found this person by accident, by asking for a lift to take us to the place where we were holding the reunion, and he got his name on this lapel. He says, I've been told look for you. You're Sam Corson. I said, I've been told look for you. We found her just like that outside the cathedral on Saturday night. It's our little memorial plot. We had a little service. And anyway, from there, the man who he's staying with is the man who had not been to the cathedral till 8 years ago and lived in Durham all his life. He'd not been to the cathedral. And he got friends with the verger. He's so interested in the cathedral, he's been there every year since, and he goes many a Sunday. And he knows the vergers. And this particular verger, who's in charge of the Durham Chapel, he says, I've had a word with him, Sam. He says, after we've finished our little service at Sunday morning, he says, I've got to go and fetch him, and he'll come down and unlock the book for us, and look in the book for us, to find this man's name. And he did just that. And we found this man's name, and this man who we were looking for was the very first person who lost his life in the Durham Light Infantry. And he didn't lose it abroad. He didn't lose it in action. He was drowned in Winchelsea. He was drowned in Winchelsea on a day's out. An organised swim in a pond somewhere. He dove in and got fast in the weeds and never come to the top. They had to go and dig him out. And his name is the first 16th Durham Light Infantry in the book.